It's Tuesday, December 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a new poll reveals many Americans believe the U.S. is losing the campaign against terror.
ISIS is showing itself to be a durable, effective, persistent, lethal threat. And we should be doing more to counter that threat.
A French journalist will be expelled from China because she criticized Beijing's treatment of its Uyghur minority. And we'll hear about the latest film version of the Shakespearean tragedy, Macbeth. It's all ahead. A new national poll reveals that despite recent setbacks, the rise of the Islamic State has convinced a large minority of Americans surveyed that terrorists are winning the war against extremism. The poll, conducted by the cable news network CNN and Opinion Research Corporation, shows 40% say the terrorists have the upper hand. The results follow a series of events, including the mass shootings in Paris and California, and the perception that the government's anti-terror response has been inadequate. Nearly three-quarters said they are dissatisfied with the progress in the war on terror, and a majority are unhappy with the Obama administration's response, especially the policy on defeating the Islamic State. Tom Sanderson, director of the Transnational Threat Program at the Washington-based Centers for Strategic and International Studies, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, it's difficult to determine who's actually winning, and the issue will play a significant role in the 2016 U.S. presidential election.
I would certainly say that ISIS is very strong. They are on the march in many places. They are losing territory in other places. But generally speaking, I do think that ISIS is showing itself to be a durable, effective, persistent, lethal threat. And we should be doing more to counter that threat, but I don't think we need to act like we are under siege and under attack and that this is an existential threat.
Tom, what are the implications for the 2016 election?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. Candidates on the right are going to use the advances by ISIS, including the attacks in the U.S., to portray Hillary Clinton as part of a weak Obama-led response that she was originally a part of. And I think that's going to be something she will have to face down, but I think something that she can challenge quite effectively. But the Republicans do have a point that the president does not seem to be out in front of this on a messaging level. And they're claiming that also on a policy level with the strategy that he's not doing well either. And the reality is they simply don't know all of what's going on behind the scenes. Nobody does except for those people who are directly engaged on the counter-ISIS effort. And a lot is going on. I do believe more should be going on. But the implications are significant for the race.
Tom Sanderson still believes the November election will turn on both foreign and domestic issues. Max Abrams, an analyst with Northeastern University in Boston, tells Victor Beatty it's quite common for observers to believe the terrorists are winning.
Almost regardless of what the outcome of the violence happens to be, observers conclude that that's exactly what the terrorists wanted to happen. So, for example, after the 2001 terrorist attack, President Bush decided for the U.S. to occupy Iraq. And many people at the time said, don't occupy Iraq because that's exactly what al-Qaeda wants. In 2004, al-Qaeda struck Madrid in the train attack, and Spain had the opposite reaction. It withdrew its forces from Iraq. And at the time, critics said, well, that's exactly what al-Qaeda wants. So whether the terrorists provoke a country or whether they force the country into becoming more conciliatory, observers will very often conclude that that's exactly what the terrorists want. And so for that reason, people all the time tend to overestimate the skill and the sophistication and intelligence of terrorists. The fact that so many Americans think that the terrorists are winning isn't actually an indication that the terrorists are winning.
Well, do you see the numbers changing in the new year if, in fact, this decline becomes persistent?
Yes, I do. I think that there's probably a lag between what's going on in the world of Islamic State and how it's perceived by Americans. And if there are continued successes against Islamic State, I think Americans will have to change their minds, although all of that is contingent on the U.S. homeland remaining safe.
Well, among the survey's conclusions are that the White House understands that beyond a coherent and winning military strategy, it also needs a domestic plan to win the political debate over the threat of terrorism. It's time now to look at social media, and there are a number of posts about the arrests of two people in Brussels. Prosecutors in Belgium said Tuesday that police have arrested two people suspected of planning holiday terror attacks in Brussels. They said investigators found evidence pointing to the threat of serious attacks that would target several emblematic places on New Year's Eve. Prosecutors said the case was not connected to the November 13th attacks in Paris that killed at least 130 people, and several of the suspects in those attacks, including the presumed ringleader, had links to Belgium. Well, also trending today is hashtag Lemmy, with more than 700,000 tweets. The British band Motorhead announced its frontman, Lemmy, has died at the age of 70. Lemmy formed the rock group in 1975 and recorded 22 albums, including Ace of Spades, as he became one of rock music's most recognizable voices and faces. As Lemmy of Motorhead, he was known for his fast and furious bass guitar playing and gravelly voice. Lemmy lived in Los Angeles, and he died at home with his family. He had been diagnosed with cancer on Saturday, 2 days after his 70th birthday. Also trending is hashtag comfort women. South Korea and Japan reached an agreement this week designed to end decades of strained relations stemming from the forced use of Korean women in Japanese military-run brothels during World War II. The deal includes an apology from Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and a more than $8 million payment to dozens of now elderly survivors of the ordeal. We'll have more on this later in the show, and that's a look at social media. In other news, Chinese government officials won't renew press credentials for French journalist Ursula Gauthier for criticizing Beijing's treatment of its Muslim Uyghur minority. A November 18th report by Gauthier suggested China used recent terrorist attacks in Paris to justify crackdowns on Uyghur people in China's northwest Xinjiang region. The French journalist is a longtime Beijing correspondent for the French newsweekly L'Obs. Calling Gauthier's report supportive of violence committed by Uyghurs, Beijing officials are refusing to grant an extension for her press visa, which expires December 31st. Gauthier told VOA Monday that Beijing also is demanding a public apology for things she has not written.
They say it's because I'm refusing to make solemn and public apologies for what I have written on the 18th of November concerning the situation in Xinjiang. And they say that I should do these apologies to the Chinese people because I had hurt their feelings. And I'm not at all convinced that I hurt feelings of anyone with what I wrote.
Gauthier's article says some violent attacks involving Xinjiang's Uyghur community appear to have been homegrown, with little evidence of ties to global terrorism. The report also describes a deadly mine attack in Xinjiang as a possible response to what Uyghurs consider injustice and mistreatment by Beijing. That assertion echoes opinions of some regional experts and advocacy groups that have tied the violence to Beijing's repressive policies. Gauthier's article drew harsh criticism from state media and Chinese government officials. Gauthier denied the accusations, saying she has the impression that no one inside the foreign ministry has read her article.
But the Global Times distorted my writings, distorted heavily, beyond recognition, I can say. So when today the spokesperson says that I have supported terrorism, that I was, had no sympathy for innocent victims. I wonder, did he at least read my article? I'm not sure.
The Foreign Correspondents Club of China expressed concern that Beijing is using the press, accreditation and visa processing, to intimidate foreign journalists. Gauthier said her expulsion is only meant to deter foreign correspondents in the future in Beijing.
Because Chinese society has very few freedoms. So if you take all the freedoms of opinion, of expression, of press, then I'm afraid we're going back really way, way back to periods of Chinese history that we all thought were over.
On December 31st, Gauthier will become the first foreign journalist forced to leave China since 2012, when Al Jazeera correspondent Melissa Chan was expelled without formal explanation from Beijing. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Could playing Tetris, a classic video puzzle game, help drug addicts and compulsive eaters overcome or reduce their addictions or obsessions with food? Psychologists in the UK and Australia worked with 31 college students as test subjects. The students were randomly sent text message prompts 7 times throughout the day over a week-long period, asking them to report any cravings they were feeling. About half of the volunteers who reported cravings were also told to play Tetris on an iPod for 3 minutes. Following gameplay, the subjects again reported on the intensity of their cravings. The researchers found that playing Tetris can weaken cravings for drugs, cigarettes, alcohol, coffee, and food by as much as 20%. Lowered cravings were also observed in the volunteers for sex and sleeping. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the newest version of Macbeth has hit screens. We'll have a report. South Korea and Japan reached an agreement this week designed to end decades of strained relations stemming from the dispute over the forced use of Korean women in Japanese military-run brothels, a legacy of its occupation for most of the first half of the 20th century. The deal includes an apology from Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and a more than $8 million payment to the dozens of elderly survivors of the ordeal. Temple University Asian Studies professor Jeff Kingston in Tokyo tells VOA's Victor Beatty the agreement is a real breakthrough, as the two key U.S.-Asia allies have been haggling over the dispute for the past 25 years.
Leaders on both countries have seized the initiative, and they've cut a deal that they think they can live with. And so the Japanese government has agreed to pony up a little over $8 million, and this will be distributed to the 46 surviving comfort women. Some of the details, however, remain rather vague. And so, you know, Prime Minister Abe is going to issue a heartfelt apology. But over the past 20 years or so, when they've argued about this issue, Seoul has always insisted that the Japanese government acknowledge state responsibility, legal responsibility, rather than just moral responsibility. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out with the Korean public. Another big issue that they didn't really resolve is the status of the Comfort Women statue that is right across the street from the Japanese embassy in downtown Seoul. So this statue has been a real sticking point for the Japanese. They have requested numerous times that it be removed. And the Korean government said, well, it was put there by a civic organization, and we're not in position to remove it. So we'll have to see how this plays out down the road once we get more of the details. But the fact that they've reached a state-to-state agreement does solve some of the problems, but clearly Korean civic groups won't be satisfied by this agreement. And so, in a way, you could say that they are papering over the problems and the lingering animosities over this historical controversy are bound to linger.
It seemed Japan was expecting that the matter was settled back in a 1965 treaty. Did Japan make concessions to the South Koreans? Is this a real compromise?
State-to-state legal responsibilities regarding Japanese colonialism in the Korean Peninsula were resolved by the Basic Treaty of 1965. The Japanese government provided $800 million to Seoul. In the aftermath, however, some of the issues that weren't discussed in those negotiations, such as forced labor, the comfort women, those have bubbled up over the last 20, 25 years after the end of military dictatorship in Korea and the fluorescence of a civil society. So a more democratic Korea has taken to scrutinize the shared history with Japan more carefully, and they don't find that the 1965 agreement covered some of these issues. The Japanese government's legal position is it's totally covered. So this has been really one of the sticking points, and now at least the Korean government has done what it could to resolve the issue, and they created a favorable context for doing so.
Jeff Kingston says Washington has welcomed the agreement, which comes as the U.S. seeks to upgrade security cooperation with its two key Asian allies amid rising threat perceptions from China. This is VOA.
One of the world's great cities, the gateway to America for generations. VOA brings you New York in 12 rarely seen views. Presenting the 2016 VOA calendar, a gift from us free for the asking. Just send us your mailing address in an email to calendar@voanews.com and you can have New York's beauty grace your wall all next year.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. William Shakespeare's tragedy Macbeth gets a new treatment from Australian director Justin Kurzel. The film stars Oscar nominee Michael Fassbender as the doomed Scottish king and Oscar winner Marion Cotillard as his ambitious wife. International Edition's David Byrd takes a look.
Director Justin Kurzel's Macbeth opens with the title character and his wife standing next to the grave of their only child. Their grief then transitions into a blood-soaked battle scene, after which a victorious Macbeth meets three witches who tell him that he shall be king of Scotland.
Macbeth, hail to thee, Thane of Clumps.
Macbeth, hail to thee, Thane of Cawdor.
All hail Macbeth, that shall be king hereafter.
There's only one problem. Scotland has a king, Duncan, whom Lady Macbeth, played by Marion Cotillard, persuades her reluctant husband to murder when Duncan visits their castle.
I have given suck, and know how tender it is to love the babe that milks me. I would, while it was smiling in my face, have plucked my nipple from his boneless gums and dashed the brains out had I so sworn, as you have done to this.
Michael Fassbender, known for his roles in Shame, Inglourious Basterds, and the X-Men series, says taking on the role of the doomed Scot was something that required a lot from him.
There's just so many endless versions you can do and various sort of interpretations of it. It's just, which is very encouraging and also kind of depressing, because I would walk away thinking, God, you know, there was another thousand ways that could have been done. But just really becoming comfortable with it.
Cotillard, who won an Oscar for her portrayal of Edith Piaf in La Vie en Rose, says she was reluctant to take the part until she talked to director Justin Kurzel.
The way he talked about the fact that he wanted to show that they were in love with each other, and he wanted to show, yeah, the humanity of those two people really got me, and gave me the desire to be part of it.
Fassbender says Cotillard brought a new vision to the role and was a joy to work with.
She's a really very sort of unique actor, and the fact that she sort of really works very much in the moment-to-moment sort of elements of a scene. She doesn't come forcing something on a scene. She allows it to sort of organically sort of take place, and that's pretty rare.
The film was shot on location on Scotland's Isle of Skye, and the weather and the landscape play a large role in the story. Kurtzel's vision also has the characters working in spare surroundings, not grand castles, but empty, dark, cold landscapes. Battle scenes take place on muddy, wet hillsides, which also add to the feeling of desperation and isolation. Macbeth also stars David Thewlis as Duncan, Paddy Considine as Banquo, and Elizabeth Debicki as the ill-fated Lady Macduff. Macbeth is rated R for strong violence and brief sexuality. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
And that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks very much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In many conflicts worldwide, human trafficking or modern slavery is often among the most tragic consequences. And despite persistent efforts to eradicate trafficking in persons, this abhorrent crime persists. According to the International Labor Organization, over 20 million people worldwide are victims of forced labor. On September 16th, U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations and December President of the Security Council, Samantha Power, stated that for groups like ISIL and Boko Haram, slavery has become one of their most versatile weapons of war, used to instill fear, to inflict suffering, to recruit followers, reward fighters, convert people of other faiths, reward combatants, and generate revenue. In Iraq and Syria, ISIL distributes women and girls to fighters as spoils of war, systematically rapes them, and sells them in markets like cattle. ISIL has even gone so far as to encourage the sexual assault of prepubescent girls and issue guidelines on how to treat the women and girls who have been enslaved. Boko Haram also exacts horrors upon those whom it has kidnapped and enslaved. On October 2nd, the group reportedly forced four girls and a boy to become suicide bombers in the Nigerian city of Maiduguri, where they self-detonated at a mosque during evening prayers. 15 people, including these kids, were killed, and more than 35 were injured. Witnesses estimated that the bombers were as young as 9 years old. Member states must commit to ending the conflicts that enable human traffickers to operate, as well as support trafficking victims. To address this in Iraq and Syria, where ISIL has enshrined systems of human trafficking and sexual violence, the U.S.-led 65-member coalition remains determined to destroy ISIL, stem the flow of foreign terrorist fighters, and restrict its funding streams used to fuel its reign of terror. The U.S. also continues to provide security and counterterrorism assistance to the governments of Chad, Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon, and Benin to aid their fight against Boko Haram. Human trafficking in conflict is a scourge that knows no borders. That's why U.N. member states must individually combat human trafficking and coordinate efforts now to put a stop to this human tragedy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.